Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to episode 309 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where we look at mysteries from the twin perspectives of faith and reason. In this episode, Jimmy will be answering listeners' weird questions. I'm Dom Bettinelli, and joining me today is Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy.
Howdy, Dom.
So, Jimmy, what topics are you going to be answering questions about today?
We're going to be covering things like, could dark matter and dark energy be angelic or demonic? Can you pray for the souls in hell? Did baby Jesus have temper tantrums? Is string theory compatible with the faith? If there are infinite possible futures, can there be infinite possible pasts? How do Adam and Eve relate to other early human ancestors and more?
Excellent. So let's get right to your answers.
Weird questions is one of those fun times where we get to gather up some of the weirdest questions that Jimmy has received in his various public availabilities, whether it's people know him from Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or they know him from here, or from his dance calling, or wherever he's getting these. He gathers them up, and we have a great deal of fun answering weird questions. You ready to do that, Jimmy?
Yeah, sure. First, though, I thought I'd mention we have a new episode of Mysterious World out today, and it's part one of an interview I did with a Jewish scholar named Dr. Justin Sledge. And this week we talked about the secret origins of the form of Jewish mysticism known as the Kabbalah.
Oh, cool.
And so it's already been getting a lot of reaction. People have really been enjoying it. A lot of people have heard about Kabbalah, but they don't know where it came from or what it teaches. So this week we looked at where it came from and what its history is. Next week we're going to look at its secret teachings. So we have secret origins this week and secret teachings next week.
Very, very cool. You can find that and so many more fascinating mysteries over at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Here's our first weird question from the day. This comes from Pamela. Could dark energy be associated with angelic demonic energy, dark matter that God created at the beginning of the universe? As in, the reason we have missing dark matter and or energy is due to the spiritual world or dimension we can't see but know is there.
Okay, so there are several things to think about here. The first one is whether or not angels and demons have matter. The modern theory of matter, which is that it's made out of tiny particles called atoms, which are made out of even smaller particles, that's something that was proposed. Well, really, that's a modern understanding. The idea that that matter is made out of tiny particles is something that was proposed by some early Greek philosophers known as Leucippus and Democritus, but it really didn't catch on at the time. And it really wasn't until 1905 that Albert Einstein actually proved atoms even exist. So it's the modern atomic theory of matter is quite recent, and they wouldn't have had it in the ancient world. And so when you look at very early sources like Second Temple literature from before the time of Christ, or some early Christian sources, it's not clear that angels aren't made of at least similar stuff than what we're made out of. So it's not clear at that point that they definitely are immaterial. They, you know, we see, discussions of them, for example, mating with human women, which, taking it at face value, would suggest they're made out of something similar to what we're made out of. However, with the course of time, Christians came to discern that angels are radically different than us. And in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, if you look in paragraph 328, it says that they are non-corporeal, meaning they don't have a bodily form. And in paragraph 330, it says that they are purely spiritual, So that would mean they don't have matter the way we do. They don't have bodies like ours. They're created intellects. Having said that, could intellects be made out of dark matter? Well, dark matter is a substance that has been proposed by physicists to explain certain things we see in the universe. In particular, the edge of galaxies seem to be rotating in a way they shouldn't, if based on our ordinary understanding of how gravity works. And so it's been proposed that to explain these weird rotations of the galaxies, that there may be a hidden substance, hidden, which is why it's called dark. There may be a hidden form of matter or a dark form of matter that doesn't interact with light, which is why we can't see it, because light just goes right through it, but does interact gravitationally. So it would have mass that's capable of influencing the visible matter that we can see. And that's what's responsible for the motions of the rotation of galaxies and other things. Having said that, even though the majority position right now among astrophysicists is that dark matter exists, there is a counter argument, which is simply that we need to refine our theory of gravity, that maybe it doesn't work the same way on galactic scales that it works here in the solar system. Maybe we need to tweak it just a little bit, and you don't really need dark matter. So there's actually a big debate in cosmology right now about, does dark matter exist? Because we've had a real hard time finding it. Well, assuming that dark matter exists, could it be the same stuff that intellects are made out of? Well, that seems counterintuitive, so I wouldn't bet the farm on that. But if it turned out that intellects are made out of something that has mass but doesn't interact with light, then you could propose that angels and demons are dark matter, are made of dark matter, are related to dark matter. And the same thing would presumably be true of our intellects as well. But even though that's hypothetically possible, because we don't really know what spirits are made out of, I find it unlikely. So I don't think that that angels or demons are related to dark matter. They may be able to affect dark matter the same way they can affect normal matter, but I doubt very much that they are made of it.
Pamela, thank you for starting us off with a very good weird question. We got a whole bunch more weird questions. Jimmy Akin, our guest. More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin. What's the matter? Why are you doing? What are you saying in there, dear? You forgot what music? Oh, Darren just realized. Oh, well, it's been a busy week, Darren. It's been a crazy week. So Shane asks this. Is it, can you find the music during the show, or is that, maybe we'll get some weird questions and music then. Shane asks this, is it possible to pray for the souls who have already gone to hell? And if so, would it do any good? I would love to hear what you have to say, even if you can't answer my question.
Well, I think I can answer your question. It's possible to pray for someone who is already in hell. And in fact, a lot of people probably are doing that because we don't know who has gone to hell, and people nevertheless pray for them anyway. So it's certainly possible. There's nothing stopping one from doing that, and it actually probably happens. The only way it wouldn't happen is if nobody went to hell, or if somehow the people who did go to hell were people that never got prayed for. So that leads us to the second question, which is, if you are praying for someone in hell, would it do any good? Well, it depends on what you're praying. If you're praying, please let them out of hell, well, then that's not going to happen, because hell is permanent. And so if someone is in hell, you can't pray that they get out of hell. Could you pray that they don't go to hell? Could you pray across time and ask God, please give them the graces they need in the last moment of their life to repent so that they won't go to hell? Well, I talk about issues like that in an episode of Mysterious World. It's episode 208 on Time Travel Prayer, and you can listen to it by going to mysterious.fm/208 if you want to hear the whole thing. But one of the things I conclude is that while it is possible to pray concerning events in the past, like the moment of someone's death, you should not pray for things that you know to have been God's will to not happen. For example, you could pray for someone and say, you know, please give them the grace that they need to go to heaven. But if they didn't accept that grace, then it's not going to affect their state. They're still going to be in hell. It was God. And if you knew that it was God's will to allow that person to go to hell, then you shouldn't pray that he not do that. It's just like you shouldn't pray. We know that in our universe, in our timeline, the 9/11 attacks happened. That was a terrible tragedy, but God allowed it to happen. And so you couldn't, or shouldn't, I should say, pray that God cause the 9/11 attacks not to happen in our timeline. What you could do, and similarly, if you know someone died on 9/11, you shouldn't pray that that person not have died, because it was God's will to allow that person to die. However, you could pray for other things. And in the case of someone in hell, even if you know they're in hell, you don't know how bad they're suffering. Now, how bad they're suffering is something that's determined by what they did during life. And so even if someone were in hell, and even if you knew that that person was in hell, you could still pray, dear God, please help that person not commit extra sins in life so that they won't have to suffer as much when they are in hell. So I think it would be possible to pray for someone in hell and for it to have an effect. But the effect would not be getting them out of hell. The effect would be having them suffer less than they otherwise would suffer, because during life they didn't sin as badly as they otherwise would have sinned.
And I will leave it there. I hope that was helpful to you, Shane. Appreciate that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Next comes from Alba. And Alba asks, did toddler Jesus have meltdowns and temper tantrums? And can we guess if Mary ever lost her patience on him and yelled at him?
Well, we obviously don't have any record of this in the New Testament. We have mention of Jesus's birth. We have when he's between 1 and 2 years old. We have, you know, the story of the visit of the Magi. And then we flash forward to when he's 12 years old and is found at the temple. So the New Testament doesn't give us any information about this. It's speculative as a result. We do have some additional early Christian literature, though, like the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, which was a document that was written in the mid-second century, so maybe around the year AD 150. And in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas, Jesus does kind of throw tantrums. There's one point, for example, at which another child has like jostled him or something, and he strikes that child dead. So that's kind of a little tantrumy. And then Joseph, the parents of the child that Jesus struck dead, complained to Joseph. And they say, can you please talk to your son about this? Because he's killing people. And Joseph goes and talks to Jesus, and Joseph loses his temper and grabs Jesus by the ear and squeezes him by the ear. So we don't have Mary doing that, but we do have Joseph doing that. Now, the thing is, the Infancy Gospel of Thomas is a work of early Christian fiction. It's not even clear how seriously people took it at the time, but it certainly does not have value as a historical document in telling us what really happened. So even though we do have some stories of a tantrum throwing Jesus and parents getting exasperated at him, in later literature that's really not historically reliable. So what could we speculate just based on what we have in the New Testament? Well, one of the things that we see in the New Testament is that, when he was 12, Jesus did get left behind at the temple. And when Mary and Joseph found him, Mary is somewhat exasperated with him. Because she said, don't you know what your father and I have been searching for you for 3 days? So it is possible for Mary, in a non-sinful way, to experience frustration or exasperation or anxiety concerning Jesus. So I wouldn't say that that she could lose her patience with him. I wouldn't say that's intrinsically impossible. Whatever she would do, it would not be sinful. But she could, in a sinless way, experience frustration or consternation or exasperation with him. Would Jesus himself, though, have thrown tantrums? Well, one of the things that Luke stresses is that after the finding in the temple, he went back to Nazareth with Mary and Joseph and was obedient to them. So that reveals to us that Jesus was an obedient child. But is obedience inconsistent with anger? Well, no, it's not, because Jesus himself was fully obedient to his heavenly Father, and yet he got angry, like when he cleared the temple of the money changers. Mm. So if you're, let's say, a toddler, let's say you're 2 years old or 1 year old, and you don't have language yet, and you don't have the ability to speak yet, and you're hungry or you're tired or you're in pain, and Jesus could experience hunger and tiredness and pain, you might get frustrated and cry and express that the way children are programmed to. Biologically, children are programmed when they're in distress to yell. And that's the purpose of that, is to attract their parents' attention so that the parents can attend to whatever the cause of the child's distress is. So Jesus could cry, and if you want to call and yell out, and if you want to call that throwing a tantrum, well, you could say that. But what he would not have done is throw a tantrum in a sinful, selfish way. But he could have been in physical or emotional distress and yelled out to alert Mary and Joseph to that fact.
Thank you so much for that question, Alba, for that series of questions. I appreciate that very, very much. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Here's a weird one from Randy. As a matter of fact, I know it's a weird one because he starts this way. Here's a weird question for Jimmy Akin. I trust him to have both seen the problem and found what is probably a simple solution to it. Question: how is original sin, inherited from Adam and Eve, different from the biologically discredited idea of inheritance of acquired characteristics, Lamarckian evolution? In other words, it seems analogous to the story of how the bear lost his tail, easily Googled. In the spirit of transparency, I'm a professor of biological anthropology, but also a Christian. I know the scientific and religious truth in this matter can be reconciled, but I don't know enough to be able to do it by myself.
Okay, so we'll need to continue this on the other side of the break. But first, we should give some background on some of the concepts that he just mentioned so that other people will be familiar with them. The story of how the bear lost his tail is a legend among the Ojibwe Native Americans. And basically what happens in the story is an otter has a whole bunch of fish, and the bear says, well, how did you get all these fish? And the otter lies to the bear and says, well, I've got this, we got this frozen river here, and I stick my long otter tail down through a hole in the ice and use that to catch the fish. And the bear says, do you mind if I try? And the otter says, no, I got plenty of fish. Use my hole in the ice all you want. So the bear sticks his long tail down into the ice, and no fish ever bite on it. It's not he swishes his tail around. None of the fish ever bite. It's not an effective thing. And when the bear goes to leave after being disappointed, he discovers his tail has been frozen into the ice. And as he gets up, his tail comes off. And that is why bears today have short tails instead of long tails. This is very much like the Just So stories of Rudyard Kipling, like the elephant got his trunk because a baby elephant was like sniffing an alligator in a river and the alligator bit it, or a crocodile bit it and stretched it out. And so that's why elevators have long trunks. It's also like some of the Brer Rabbit stories by Joel Chandler Harris. And it's an idea that was explored, at least to some extent, by a naturalist who lived in the 1700s named Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. And it was in an early theory of evolution called Lamarckian evolution, which I'll tell you about on the other side of the break.
It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We'll try to resolve this mystery and many more when we come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live. With Jimmy Akin. Wish there was a little theremin in that. Oh, there is a little theremin in there. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin. We've already gathered them up, so we don't give out the phone number during this the opportunity, because people get the weird questions to Jimmy. They find ways to get the weird questions to Jimmy. And this one comes from
people can always email them to radio@catholic.com and they forwarded to me and I log them.
Yeah. And please do. We love getting these weird questions. This is a professor of biological anthropology that asked the question of basically how can we kind of make the theory of the loss of sanctifying grace from Adam and Eve comport with the modern theories of evolution. But Jimmy, you were in the midst of your answer.
Yeah. In the 1700s and 1800s, there was a naturalist named Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, and he theorized about evolution. So the idea of evolution, of biological evolution, it did not originate with Darwin. It has in the 1800s, it has a much longer history than that. And Lamarck proposed what was for a time a very popular theory, which today is called Lamarckianism or Lamarckian evolution. And Lamarck's idea was that if an organism uses a characteristic, that characteristic will get passed on to its offspring. Whereas if it doesn't use that characteristic, it will weaken and eventually not get passed on. Now, there's an element of truth to that, but not quite the way Lamarck thought. For Lamarck, the way you got giraffes with the really long necks was there was originally some kind of proto-giraffe that had a shorter neck, and it would stretch. It would lean up to try to get higher up leaves off of trees to eat them. And the fact it would stretch its neck caused its neck to get longer. And then because it had developed itself a longer neck, it passed that on to its offspring. And so a human analogy would be like if a man decides to become a blacksmith and he develops big muscles in his arms because he does blacksmithing, well, then his children would have stronger arm muscles. Okay, so that idea was widely discredited. Darwin pointed out that it doesn't quite work this way. Instead, there are random mutations. So you did originally have proto-giraffes with short necks, and then some of them randomly mutated to have slightly longer necks. And because they had slightly longer necks, they could get more food, and therefore they were more likely to survive and reproduce. So it wasn't the fact they were using their necks to get at the leaves that that caused their children. It was the random mutation that caused them to have longer necks, and it was the random mutation that was passed down to their children. So analogizing that to, I guess I should also say, there has been, even though original Lamarckianism has been refuted, it's experiencing something of a comeback these days in evolutionary circles because of what's known as epigenetics. Epigenetics deals with the way our genes are activated. So in different cells of our bodies, different genes are switched on, so to speak. And that's why even though every cell in your body has the same genetic code, some cells manifest as kidney cells, and other cells manifest as skin cells, and other cells manifest as muscle cells. What determines the cell type is not the genes, because they all have the same genes. It's which genes are activated.
Okay.
And what activates them are these things that kind of go on top of the genes. And that's why it's called epigenetics. It means upon the genes. And it turns out that something like Lamarckian evolution happens with epigenetics. There was, for example, a study that came out in 2013 about mice. And what the scientists did was they would expose male mice to the scent of cherry blossoms. They had a chemical that's in cherry blossoms that gives them their distinctive smell. And they would expose the mice to the scent of the cherry blossom and shock them, you know, electrically. So very quickly, this is like a reverse. This is like a Pavlov's dog nightmare.
Yeah.
You have the pleasant aroma of cherry blossoms, but every time you smell it, you get a shock. And so the mice quickly learned to fear the smell of cherry blossoms. And they also developed more sensors in their noses to detect the cherry blossom scent, so they would know when the shock is coming. Well, that turned on certain genes in the male mice, and the epigenetic markers that turned on those genes got passed on to the mice's offspring.
Oh, how interesting.
And so even though these new baby mice pups had never met their fathers and had never smelled cherry blossom before, as soon as the scientists exposed the mice pups to cherry blossom smell, they got agitated and freaked out. And they also found that these pups had more of the olfactory cherry blossom detector cells as well. So the epigenetics had passed down from the adult male mice to their offspring. And it was a situation where you have one generation learns to do something and the next generation inherits that. So there's been a kind of revival of some Lamarckian ideas in epigenetics. Now, let's apply all that to original sin. The essence of original sin, as you mentioned, spoiler warning, is that it's a deprivation of sanctifying grace. And sanctifying grace is not itself material. So original sin itself is a non-biological phenomenon. It doesn't affect us genetically. It's not part of who we are on a molecular level. But the stain of original sin, which is the consequences of original sin, includes things like disordered desires. And we know that people can have disordered desires because of their genes, or because, you know, like some people inherit a predisposition to alcoholism or something. And the same thing could be true epigenetically. If people are subjected to certain stresses, their descendants may have certain problems. And so so even though original sin itself is non-biological, the stain of original sin or disordered desires has a biological component. So how could we explain that if you have Adam and Eve in an unfallen state where they're not experiencing disordered desires and then their descendants do? Well, one way of explaining it is to say, okay, these disordered desires resulted from the ordinary process of evolution, which isn't perfect. And then when God gave Adam and Eve their souls, he also gave them that original grace, which neutralized their disordered desires. And so it wasn't functioning in their pre-fall state. But then when they fell and lost the sanctifying grace, the stain reasserted itself. And because it was in there on the genetic level, it also got passed on to their offspring. So there wouldn't have been a genetic or an epigenetic change. It's just that the effects of original grace would have suppressed the stain of original sin until that grace was lost. A second option that occurs to me is, well, genetic damage can occur to people in a single generation and be passed on to their offspring.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you get exposed to radiation and it affects your reproductive organs, it can affect your offspring. So it's possible that when original sin happened and Adam and Eve lost that grace, it could have caused biological damage to them on a genetic level or on an epigenetic level. And thus, even though you don't normally see significant massive mutations in a single generation, you could have seen it here because of the nature of the of what happened. It could have done genetic damage that was passed on, or it could have done epigenetic damage and turned on the wrong stuff that then got passed on.
What a fascinating question. I hope that that was satisfying to you as a biological anthropologist. And yeah. I'd be interested if you've got a follow-up question, Randy, because that was kind of a fun little journey. The next question, Jimmy, I want to give you time to answer. So we're a little early for the break, but I'm going to take the break and we'll come back and we'll have plenty of time for the next weird question for Jimmy Akin.
We'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make this show possible, including Chad M., Dion M., Martin G., Colleen T., and Brant T. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and all the shows at StarQuest. And you can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World is also brought to you by DeliverContacts.com, offering top brand contact lenses at always low prices with free delivery. Visit DeliverContacts.com. And by Rosary Army, featuring award-winning Catholic podcasts, rosary resources, videos, and the School of Mary online community, prayer, and learning platform. Learn how to make them, pray them, and give them away while growing in your faith at RosaryArmy.com and SchoolofMary.com.
To interrupt a good theremin, you know, I don't like to talk over a good piece of theremin music. That's the weird questions music. So it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And when you hear that music, you know, you're about to hear a weird question. And this one comes from Parent Prime Mover on Twitter. I think, I don't know, Primover? Is that Prime? I don't know how you're supposed to say
it. It's spelled ambiguously. It could be Primover or Prime Mover.
Is string theory, or implications drawn from string theory, incompatible with theism and Christianity?
Well, string theory is a theory about the fundamental nature of matter. So we know that matter is made out of atoms, and atoms are made of smaller particles like electrons, protons, and neutrons. And protons and neutrons are made of smaller particles known as quarks. The idea is that they're fundamentally, though, if you get down to the bottom level, matter is going to be made out of something called strings. And so this is simply a theory to explain the observed motions of matter and how it interacts with itself and so forth. String theory is thus compatible with a wide range of religious and philosophical positions. There's nothing about, oh, matter is made out of strings. Well, that doesn't contradict anything in the Christian faith. So in principle, it's string theory is consistent with Christianity and with theism. But then you have, now I should point out, string theory was really dominant for a while in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. It's starting to fall out of favor now. Because we really don't have good evidence for it. And things like the Large Hadron Collider have not turned up the evidence for string theory that were predicted. For example, it was predicted that every normal particle has a counterpart particle called a sparticle. And it was predicted as soon as we turn on the Large Hadron Collider, we're going to see sparticles. And so we're going to, and we didn't. So that prediction failed. And many, many other predictions made on the basis of string theory are not testable, because in order to test them, you would need, a particle accelerator the size of a galaxy. And others are just ideas that don't even make testable predictions. And so so string theory has started to decrease in popularity, but it is in principle compatible with theism and with Christianity. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that everybody says about string theory is going to be compatible. But then that's true of atomic theory in general. You have some people who say, oh, yeah, matter is made of atoms and atoms is all there is. There's no God. There's no spirits. It's all atoms or smaller particles. Well, OK, that's not compatible with Christianity or with theism. And in the same way, some people will look at string theory and say, oh, here's an understanding of it that doesn't make room for God. You know, Stephen Hawking did that in one of his books shortly before his death. Well, OK, well, then that understanding is not compatible with theism or with Christianity, just like a matter only understanding of atomic theory is not compatible. But it's not the problem. The atomic theory is not the problem, and the string theory is not the problem. It's the way it's being used or how it's being interpreted.
Parent Prime Mover, thanks very much for a good string theory question. Another weird question comes from Joe, and Joe asks this: in terms of the theory of infinite possible futures, are there an infinite number of past timelines, or do all possibilities combine into a single past timeline?
Okay, so God knows the history of every possible world, everything that could happen. And if you imagine the current moment in time as like a slice of time, you could map the position of every particle in the universe within that slice of time right now. Okay, so imagine we've got a map of every particle in the universe right now. Well, God can not only can, but does imagine every way those particles could evolve in the future, all of their future interactions, all the ways it could go. Similarly, God can and does imagine everything that could have led up to the current state. And there's not just one way to lead up to the current state. There are multiple things that could have happened that could have resulted in every particle being exactly where it is right now. You know, maybe a particle took one trajectory to get where it is right now, or maybe it took some other trajectory to get where it is right now. The only thing that's determined is that's where it is right now. And so there are an infinite number of conceivable futures in terms of where particles could go, and there are an infinite number of conceivable pasts where particles could have come from, and God knows all of them. So God knows all of these possible pasts and possible futures. Are any of them real? Well, we don't know. But what I can tell you is that some in the physics community take the idea of an infinite number of pasts seriously. This is a theory that was proposed by a 20th century physicist named Richard Feynman. And he noticed that you could do certain aspects of physics really well if you imagined a particle moving between point A and point B, taking every possible path between those two points. And if you calculate all of the different paths it could take and do a summary of them, it will model what we actually see really well. And so some people have said, maybe particles do that. Maybe they really do take every possible path between point A and point B. And this is known as the sum over histories or path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. It's a matter of interpretation. It's not something that's been proved, but it has been something that physicists following Richard Feynman have at least entertained, because if you do the math this way, it's a very good model of what we actually see. And so there is speculation that there are an infinite number of histories leading up to every moment in time.
Freaky. Thanks for that weird question. I'm going to try to get some more weird. As a matter of fact, I'm anxious to get to the next one, because this one I'm very, very interested in. Let me see. Am I in the right spot? Yep. Brian asks this. Could you speak a bit about Adam and Eve and the other hominids, many of which seem to have used tools, bury their dead, and made cave art?
Okay, so I assume what Brian is asking about is, what would Adam and Eve's relationship have been to these other humans? Like, would other hominids, would they have been rational human beings that would have been, you know, descendants of Adam and Eve, or what? Well, so we do know that there were a variety of different hominids in up until several thousand years ago. And some of them did use tools, they buried their dead, and they made cave art. And they weren't Homo sapiens sapiens, which is what we are. They were like Homo neanderthalensis, or they were Denisovians. There's a new one that's been found in China called Dragon Man. But they weren't us. And so they weren't our exact subspecies. So what can we make from the different things they left behind? Well, tool use, to my mind, is not itself particularly significant, because there are other creatures that are clearly non-human that use tools. Dolphins will sometimes use sponges as a kind of nose guard when they're doing certain things, and they have to modify a sponge in order to use it as a nose guard. So a tool is essentially an object you modify and then use for some purpose. Similarly, apes, certain apes in Africa do what you might call termite fishing, where they've got a termite mound and they want to get the termites out of it. And so what they do is they take a stick and they modify the stick, so it's, you know, they rip off all the little sub branches so it'll fit down a hole in the termite mound. And they stick it down in the termite mound, and when the termites stick to it, they pull it up and they eat the termites. And so they go termite fishing. Well, okay, so tools. Also, some birds use tools. So tool use itself isn't particularly significant to me. Cave art is a little more interesting, because it suggests symbolic patterns of thought. You know, painting a picture of a horse, it's like, okay, that's a symbol of a horse. So that, you know, is more significant, but it doesn't show me that they had the same kind of souls that we do. What I think does is burying the dead. Now, burying the dead itself doesn't mean they have the concept of an afterlife, because the dead start to smell, and they pose a biological hazard. And so, you know, cats bury their waste, and they don't have any special significance to their waste. It just smells bad, and they're bred to bury it. So humans, early humans, could have said, okay, this person is not moving anymore and they smell bad, so we're going to put them under the earth so that we don't have that problem. So what I think does reveal belief in an afterlife is grave goods. All over the world, we find, and this is true primarily of Homo sapiens sapiens graves, but it's also true of like Neanderthal graves, where we seem to find goods that someone used in life that have been buried with the person. And that could be because they believed the person would somehow use the item in the afterlife, or because they thought it would be comforting to the person to be buried with that, or something. But if you find grave goods, that suggests you've got the concept of the afterlife. And so I think some of these hominids did have the concept of the afterlife. And if you have the concept of the afterlife, then I think you've got an afterlife. The question would then be, are these other hominids part of mankind in the biblical sense. Now, obviously, the biblical author didn't know about them. You know, they hadn't been, their bones had not been found. And so they were unknown to the biblical author. But thinking theologically, whether they would count as modern humans is going to depend on whether you need a rational soul of the modern human type to have an afterlife. There have been various philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas who argued that in order to have an afterlife, you need a rational soul. And if you don't have a rational soul, you won't survive death. I've gone over those arguments and I don't find them. If Aquinas is right about that and these other hominids had the concept of the afterlife, then that would tell us that they have rational souls, and thus they would be humans in the biblical sense, and thus descendants of Adam and Eve. So you'd have to push Adam and Eve way back in history in order to account for these guys. On the other hand, I've been over those arguments, and I don't find them persuasive. In fact, I did an episode of Mysterious World. It's episode 203. So you can go to mysterious.fm/203 to listen to it. But I did a whole episode on those arguments and some surprising evidence that animals actually may have an afterlife. And so if that's the case, if you don't need a modern rational soul in order to survive death, then we wouldn't have to say that Denisovans and Neanderthals and Dragon Man were descendants of Adam and Eve. They could have just been other people who would have survived death and are not man in the biblical sense. So there are different options there.
What a wonderful question, Brian. Thank you so much. I got to say, Dragon Man won the naming contest. If you're going to be a Neanderthal or Denisovian or a Dragon Man, mm-hmm. I'm going to go with Dragon Man.
Well, he certainly leveled up. Yeah,
he leveled up. Jimmy, thanks for a great week. Thanks for being with us every single day this week and doing all these weird questions for us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So those were some great answers. Jimmy, anything else you want to say before we close?
Just a reminder that I'm going to be teaching the Introduction to Parapsychology course at the Ryan Education Center this May and June. The Ryan has asked me to teach their online Introduction to Parapsychology course last fall, and it was a big success. So they've asked me to teach the course again. It's an 8-week course that we'll be offering live in May and June, but you don't have to be at the lectures live. They're all recorded, and you'll have at least 6 months to watch them at your leisure. You can either audit the course, meaning just take it for your own information and interest, or you could take it for a grade. And if you pass, then you get a special certificate signed by me. It's really interesting, and I hope you'll join me. It covers fascinating information that any fan of Mysterious World would love. Furthermore, the Ryan has also asked me to teach a course on Christianity and parapsychology this August, and a world religions and parapsychology course this fall. So by taking Intro to Parapsychology now, you can be in a good position to get the most out of the religion-themed courses I'll be teaching in the latter part of the year. Just go to Rhine, that's rhineedu.org to learn more. Once again, it's rhineedu.org, and we'll also have a link to that in the show notes for you.
Excellent. So now it's time to hear from you. What are your theories about the topics that we covered and the weird questions that Jimmy answered today? You can let us know by visiting sqpn.com or the Jimmy Akins Mysterious World Facebook page, sending us an email to feedback@mysterious.fm, sending a tweet to @MYS_world, visiting the StarQuest Discord community at sqpn.com/discord, or calling our Mysterious feedback line at 619-738-4515. That's 619-738-4515.
And I want to say a special word of thanks to Oasis Studio 7 for the video and animation work in this episode. You can hire them for your video and animation work, and you can see the kind of work they do by checking out the video version of the podcast at my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Jimmy Akin. While you're there, I'd appreciate it if you help me grow the channel.
you can do that in several ways. One of them is by subscribing to the channel, and you also should hit the bell notification so you get notified whenever I have a new video, which is usually several times a week now. You can also help the channel by liking and commenting on the videos. That tells YouTube's algorithm that you found them engaging, and so the algorithm ought to show them to other people too, because they'll find them engaging. And for all your efforts in helping me grow my channel, I really thank you.
Jimmy, what's our next episode going to be about?
Next week, we're going to begin looking at a very interesting story involving ghosts, and it has lots of dramatic twists and turns in it. The story was chronicled by a paranormal author named Joe Fisher, so we're going to begin telling you the story of Joe Fisher's spirit guides.
Folks, be sure to get your very own Mysterious World t-shirt, mug, and more. You can see if you're watching the video, see the t-shirt I'm wearing in our merchandise shop at sqpn.com/merch. You can find links to Jimmy's resources from our discussion on our show notes at mysterious.fm/309. And remember, to help us continue to produce the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. Jimmy Yakin's Mysterious World is also brought to you by Tim Shevlin's Personal Fitness Training for Catholics, providing spiritual and physical wellness programs and daily accountability check-ins. Strengthen yourself to help further God's kingdom. Work out for the right reason with the right mindset. Learn more by visiting fitcatholics.com. And by The Grady Group, a Catholic company bringing financial clarity to their clients across the United States, using safe money options to produce reasonable rates of return for their clients. Learn more at gradygroupinc.com. And by Great Lakes Customs Law, helping importers and individuals with seizures, penalties, and compliance with U.S. customs matters throughout the United States. Visit GreatLakesCustomsLaw.com. Until next time, Jimmy Yakin, thank you for exploring with us our mysterious world.
Thanks, Dom.
And once again, I'm Dom Bettinelli. Thank you for listening to Jimmy Yakin's Mysterious World on StarQuest. If you've enjoyed Jimmy Yakin's Mysterious World, you'll also enjoy another StarQuest Network show, The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. Find it wherever you can find podcasts or at sqpn.com/secrets.